This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakraborty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And we'll begin today with a trove of newly released documents about our money and how much of it is paying for police SWAT teams, armored vehicles, and military-style assault weapons. For a while now, the ACLU of Massachusetts has been concerned about the militarization of local police departments, whether it's necessary and what it costs.
So they asked a regional law enforcement group called the Northeastern Massachusetts Law Enforcement Council, or NEMLEC, to release information about what they do and what it costs. NEMLEC is an association of 61 police and sheriff's departments in northeastern Massachusetts that share SWAT teams, automatic weapons, and combat gear to carry out special law enforcement operations.
When NEMLEC refused to release the information, the ACLU went to court, and eventually they settled with NEMLEC, which has just released hundreds of documents about its operations. Joining me now is Cade Crockford. She's director of the Technology for Liberty Project with the Massachusetts ACLU. They filed the lawsuit, and Cade has reviewed the documents, about 900 of them. And welcome back to Radio Boston, Cade. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners are going to be involved in this conversation. In a moment, listeners will hear from one of the top cops at NEMLEC. And we want to ask you, is it a good thing that police have access to SWAT teams and combat equipment? Or are you concerned about the militarization of your local police force? And do you know how much of your tax dollars are being spent on all of this? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Cade, we gave a quick description there, Meghna did, about what NEMLEC is, but maybe we should just start there, just to sort of expand that a little bit. What is NEMLEC?
NEMLEC is one of various regional law enforcement councils in Massachusetts, and as Meghna said, they essentially pool resources and personnel in order to create larger forces with more equipment and organization, enabling them to train specifically for SWAT deployments and things like that in a manner that especially smaller police departments could not be able to do on their own.
Right. So what prompted the ACLU of Massachusetts to go after these documents? What are you concerned about?
3 years ago, not just the Massachusetts ACLU, but ACLU affiliates throughout the country filed public records requests with police departments and regional SWAT groups like NEMLEC, asking for this kind of information because we were concerned about mostly mission creep in terms of the war on drugs and SWAT teams, which were originally created for things like responding to riots, as well as dealing with hostage situations, barricade scenarios, active shooter, you know, imminent violent crises. We saw nationwide, just through media reporting, that increasingly, SWAT teams were being deployed in civilian homes, in our neighborhoods, against our neighbors. These raids sort of look like joint special operations night raids that you might think are happening in a foreign country that the U.S. military is conducting. Sometimes they bust the door open, they throw flashbang grenades. There are 30, 40, 50 people surrounding a house. They bring armored trucks, in some states, tanks. So we were concerned about this, the spillover of this kind of militarization into the war on drugs.
Right. Now, what makes this possible? I mean, why suddenly do these, or it's not so sudden, actually, but it's really in the wake of 9/11, isn't it, that local police departments have access to this kind of heavy-duty military equipment?
That's right. For a long time, since the war on drugs really kicked off in the 1970s, the federal government has been providing a lot of resources to local police to fight that war. And it truly is a war. And since 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security was created, for example, and DHS has redoubled those efforts in the name of fighting terrorism. So literally billions of dollars have come from the federal government down to state and local police departments nationwide to fund all sorts of things, from surveillance cameras to Bearcats. And NEMLEC,
Bearcats being big armored vehicles, right, that can transport what I think up to 10 or 15 armed officers and a lot of equipment. And we saw them 2 years ago in the wake of the shootout there and the search for the Marathon bombers, for example, rolling through the streets of Watertown.
Right. They cost $250,000. In fact, the company that manufactures them, Lenco, is based here in Massachusetts. So it's a local company. But what we've seen with the war on terror is that money that is provided to local law enforcement,
yeah,
through these Homeland Security grants is often used to purchase equipment that is then used to conduct these drug raids. And the reason for that is actually part of the reason for that is good. It's because we don't have terrorism very much. It's very rare that there's an act of terrorism in Massachusetts. In fact, the Boston Marathon attack was the one incident that any of us can remember. On the other hand, drug raids and the drug war are extremely common. So we wanted to know not just what we're reading in the newspaper, but what is actually going on. What is the big picture in these law enforcement agencies? We want to see all the reports.
And so what are these documents, this trove of 900 or so documents, what patterns emerge? What did you learn from them?
So in those 900 documents, there are about 80 what are called after-action reports. And so these are reports that the SWAT team, NEMLEC, writes after conducting a deployment. We learned that about half of those deployments, 43%, were to serve search warrants or arrest warrants. So that is a completely different thing from what we are told the purpose of SWAT teams is, which is to, again, respond to extremely violent scenarios, right? The Watertown manhunt, an active shooter situation like the movie theater in Colorado. 43% of these deployments are a far cry from that. They are routine law enforcement operations to serve warrants. And 21 of those, 63% of those warrant operations are related to drugs. So it confirmed not just what we had feared about what's going on in Massachusetts, but also what the ACLU in other states found is occurring nationwide.
And we'll actually talk about that. What is happening nationwide? Are the numbers the same? Is it about 40% of these kinds of actions are being put into effect just to go after drugs?
In fact, the statistics in other places are much worse. In other states, the ACLU found on average about 80% of the warrant of the SWAT raids are to serve warrants, and about 60% of those warrants are related to drugs.
Right. So what do you take away from that? I mean, is this a case of overkill in your view? Is it threatening local communities? I mean, what's the overriding concern about this?
Well, what's particularly disturbing is, and this is not to blame NEMLEC. I need to make that very clear. It's not the police department's fault that the war on drugs is a massive policy failure on every level. Drug abuse in Massachusetts is a worse problem today than it was in the 1970s. Drug deaths from heroin have quadrupled, a study just published today has found over the past 10 or so years. Now, there's a counterpoint to that. There's a different example. We don't have to do things this way. In Portugal, for example, where they decriminalized drug possession, even of dangerous drugs like heroin, the exact opposite thing happened over about the same 10-year period of time. Drug deaths from heroin dropped by 50% after they stopped incarcerating people who are experiencing a public health crisis, who are addicts. And so these records, to me, suggest that we are throwing good money after bad, that we are continuing to fight the war on drugs, even though we know many of us, including law enforcement officials, Sheriff Tompkins the other day said that the war on drugs is a joke. The police chief in Gloucester has said that we shouldn't treat addicts like criminals, that we need to treat this as a public health issue. And instead of doing that, we are throwing more money into militarizing our police to conduct these kinds of raids. And the war on drugs is being conducted in Bearcats, frankly.
But isn't part of the problem here is the equipment is there. And so police departments are going to be tempted to use that equipment. And arguably, the equipment is there for good reason. I mean, we got a view of the massive amounts of military equipment available to local law enforcement 2 years ago, right, in the wake of the Boston Marathon bombing. And recently we talked to the police of Watertown police chief, Ed DeVoe, about concerns over militarization of local police force. And not surprisingly, he talked about what his fellow police officers went through in Watertown 2 years ago during the shootout with Tamerlan and Jahar Tsarnaev. So here's what he said.
I think we should have access to some, if not most, of the equipment that we had in Watertown 2 years ago. We had people here in Watertown that were truly in fear. And at one of the early meetings I had a person raise their hand and say to me, "Chief, I never thought I'd see the day that an armored vehicle came down my street." And I said, "And you liked it, didn't you?" And this person said, "You're damn right I did." in that day, we were up against bombs. We, you know, first time in, like, in America we're being shot at. We're having bombs thrown at law enforcement. We should have more stuff than them, if you will. We should win every fight when it comes to that as law enforcement, as a society. So we need to have that stuff.
So my question is, Cade, what do we do about that? I mean, it's overkill until it's not, you know? So once these horses, I guess, are out of the barn, how do you get them back in?
Well, the question is how you use tools, right? Yeah. It's not whether or not police departments may have a Bearcat necessarily, although I think that ultimately should be up to taxpayers and to people who vote in a democratic society to decide those sorts of things. But it, you know, what we are taking issue with here is really how these SWAT teams are being deployed. Terrorism, again, is very rare. The war on drugs is the meat of everyday police work in the United States. And the people who are being targeted are us. They're our families, our communities, our neighbors. So what I think is really important about this document dump, about the fact that we were able to obtain these documents only after a lawsuit, unfortunately, is that it gives the public an opportunity to view these documents. People can go to our website and read these documents for themselves. And you can decide. You know, there, in fact, this is such a good example of how transparency is so critical for an informed citizenry. Because when I was reading through these documents, my own assumptions about SWAT teams were challenged. Because I read a whole bunch of cases in which these SWAT teams went into very violent situations in which someone was holding a knife and threatening to kill the police and even lunged at a police officer with a knife. And the cop who showed up on the scene didn't think that he could deal with the situation safely, so backed away, de-escalated, called the SWAT team, people who are prepared, people, as the name says, special weapons and tactics, who are prepared and trained for this sort of thing, and they de-escalated the situation and arrested the man without shooting him. Now, that is a very different outcome from what we have seen in Boston not once but twice in the recent month, when first the FBI and the Boston police and then a state trooper shot people dead in the street simply because they were holding knives. Now, so, you know, the full picture is really what we need. I'm not, you know, slamming NEMLEC. The purpose of this is not to shame the police. The purpose is to air all of the information about what police departments are doing so that we as members of the public in an engaged democratic society can have a meaningful conversation about what's going right and what's going wrong and how to fix the things that are messed up.
All right, listeners. Well, there's the question. Is it a good thing to have that police have access to SWAT teams and combat equipment? My guess is most people would say yes. But what about Cade Crockford's question there? How information can help us make good decisions about this and about the use of force, about the potential militarization of local police forces? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. And let me bring John Fisher into the conversation. He's the police chief for the town of Carlisle, and he's also the current president of the NEMLAC Executive Board. And Chief Fisher, welcome to Radio Boston. It's really good to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So I'd like to just get you to respond to what Cade Crockford took away from this document dump. And I'll start with that figure. 43% of SWAT team deployments were essentially for the war on drugs. What's your response to that? Does that sound like a good use of this military-style equipment?
It is, if that's what the community needs. Because remember, the request comes from the community. The community reaches out to NEMLEC, and then the person that's in control of that particular incident scores it using a national standard. Is it appropriate or not appropriate to use a SWAT team? And if it scores high enough in things like dangerousness, it almost exclusively involves dangerousness of the suspects involved and the activities that they are currently involved in or have been involved in the past. And if the dangerousness rises to the level where a SWAT team is called for, then we coordinate with that city or town. So that's the important piece of that. So I do think they're important. I do think it's an important resource for the cities and towns to have, because these are folks that train and they can keep the whole situation safer. That conducting business this way is best for the police officers involved, the suspects involved and the citizens.
But is there a danger, Chief, that if that equipment is there, there might be a temptation to use it where it's not necessarily needed? I mean, we mentioned there are 900 pages in this document dump. I certainly haven't been able to look through everything. But I was looking, for example, at examples of when a SWAT team was called in for crowd control and security. And one of the examples was the visit of the Dalai Lama in Medford. Another one was a high school graduation in Waltham. Another one was Halloween in Salem, Massachusetts. Now, there might be good reasons. I'm sure you could provide good reasons for why SWAT teams were called in. But on the surface, as a citizen, I'm sort of scratching my head and saying, really? I mean, high school graduation, do we really need a SWAT team for that?
Those weren't SWAT team operations. So the differentiation is those were regional response team responses. So there are over 200 officers that work in the regional response team. There are only 30 officers that work in the SWAT team. But for an incident in a community that feels they need additional resources, so they've used all their resources. Well, you picked the Halloween in Salem example. For Salem, they're going to use all their folks. And then they need separate other police officers who are trained in crowd control, who can operate on the same radio frequency, who have trained with their folks, who can come in and help with security. So they're just other police officers. That's not a SWAT team call out. So that's not what you saw in that after action report. That's a regional response team. And there is a significant difference between the regional response team and the SWAT team.
Mm. Cade, what did you take away from those examples of when either regional response teams were called in or SWAT teams were called in? Were there examples in particular that sort of stood out to you that made you wonder if it was necessary?
Again, for us, the major issue here is the deployment of militarized police forces to enter people's homes in the middle of the night, often between 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning. What was really disturbing to me reading these documents was to see that in many of these cases, when Nemelec SWAT was going in to serve a drug warrant in someone's home, they knew in advance that there were small children in the house, and they still went in the middle of the night. Now, you know, there's clearly in all of these cases, no one was killed. No one was seriously injured. That, you know, that's not the claim that we are making here. That doesn't mean, however, that the family was not traumatized by that event. I mean, I can only imagine if I was sleeping in my bed at 4 o'clock in the morning with my children in the next room, how it might feel to have all of a sudden my door broken down and 30 armed, masked men in camouflage enter my home and point guns at me, screaming at me. My children are crying in the next room. I mean, this is a really serious incident that's mm-hmm. taking place, and it happens over and over again. And again, this is not to point the finger at NEMLEC. NEMLEC is just the organization that we got documents from. This happens throughout the Commonwealth. This happens throughout our country. Some estimates, Radley Balco, who's a police militarization expert, has suggested there are between 100 and 200 SWAT raids per day in the United States. So that means there's probably one happening right now. And so this is, you know, it's the mundane sort of routine dragging on of the drug war that I think comes through in these documents. And again, that's a policy matter. It's not, you know, Mr. Fisher's fault.
No, and of course we're not suggesting that it is Chief Fisher's fault, but he's there on the front line. So it's just interesting. So Chief Fisher, I mean, respond to that concern that Cade brought up. I mean,
well, there's a couple of important points.
Yeah,
and that is, I would ask her to refer to one of those where we were there at 4 o'clock in the morning. Because I went to the majority of those calls, and I can't think of any where we were there in the dark. They almost exclusively, I can't think of any warrants we've done that have been in the dark. The despondent people, suicidal people, absolutely. But I can't think of any calls where we were there in the dark. They're almost exclusively during the day. And I've got to tell you that one of the things that really changes whether we use a SWAT team or not in NEMLEC is whether there is any possibility that children are present. I can tell you that each of the people in control, I can think of several instances just in the last few months where we've said no to using a SWAT team because there were going to be children present. And the it reaches a point where it's not the safest thing to do. The safest thing to do is not to do a raid. So, and I don't mean to be contentious, because I think that we had a very good working relationship with the ACLU throughout this, and I don't like to speak ill of that piece, but I don't think she's going to be able to come up with a spot where we went in the middle of the night and woke up children. And
well, Chief Fisher, just stand by, because I want to get some calls into this segment. We've got a lot of listeners who want to get in on this conversation. Let's go to John, who's calling from Hanover. John, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? I just wanted to call and mention a case of overkill regarding my son when he was in college. He was a sophomore, and he was selling some drugs. And about 2 in the morning, their door got kicked in by a combination of the local police and the DEA with machine guns, helmets, bulletproof vests, and so forth. My son found himself on the floor in a chokehold, dragged down the stairs and so forth. And to me, it was an extreme overreaction to the situation. And I think it could have been easily accomplished by the local police if they were just waiting outside on the stairs in the morning when the boys were going to class. And that was just, to me, an extreme case of overuse of violence.
All right, John, we're going to take that point, put it on the table, and come back to it. But I want to get at least one more call in before we do. So let's go to Joe, who's calling from Charlestown. Joe, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's on your mind, Joe?
I worry that the line between police work and the military is becoming blurred. Like, a lot of friends who came home from Iraq or Afghanistan being the Marines or the Army or things like that, and they go, a lot of them went straight into police work or firemen or things like that, but it seems like they already come back with, and they're my friends and I respect what they do, but it seems like they come back with a military mentality, whereas police work is different than the military. Civilians in America have rights to get that they don't in Iraq or Afghanistan when you deal with people, and it seems like already coming back with that mentality. I don't know if it's a good thing to reinforce it by giving them tanks and machine guns to roll around with and act as though there's no difference between it. So,
all right, Joe, we got it. Chief Fisher, I'd love it if you could respond to those last two calls. John talking about being worried about an overreaction, and of course that wasn't necessarily a knock on anything you guys do with NEMLAC, but it's related to this concern about, you know, hyper-equipped local police forces perhaps showing up with more hardware than is necessary.
Well, I think the amount of hardware that's necessary is exactly the point. The thought to keep the police officers safe and to keep the suspects safe and keep the other people safe is what the impetus behind using the SWAT team is, what we use the SWAT team for. I don't have any personal knowledge of the case he's talking about. Doesn't sound like it was an NEMLAC case. I think that safety is absolutely what we're shooting for. And we've got to be at least and better equipped than the folks we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I believe Attorney Crockford spoke about the violence and the amount of illegal narcotics that are in our cities and towns. These are some bad folks that are doing this selling, and our warrants are almost exclusively focused on people who are armed while doing this. This is not John Q. Citizen sitting at home minding their own business in the middle of the night sleeping. These are folks who are involved in very, very serious illegal activity.
If I might respond to that.
Go ahead, Kate Crawford.
I just, you know, with all due respect, Chief Fisher, your own documents suggest something different. And they suggest that, you know, when the SWAT team at NEMLAC is deployed to serve a drug warrant, it's usually done so on the basis of an allegation from a confidential informant that the target may be armed. And again, the key word there is may be armed. Or is based on someone's prior criminal history, which in those documents includes arrests, not just convictions. So,
but if someone may be armed, Kate, don't you have to go in there assuming that they are armed?
Well, let's look at the results. So the results of these raids, in 21 of the drug warrant raids, they found one gun, according to these documents. So that's a pretty low rate of return in terms of the accuracy of the predictions of whether people will actually be armed.
May I speak to that? I don't mean to interrupt you.
I just wanted to say one more thing, is that, again, the criticism more broadly of the drug war and militarized police being deployed in the drug war is not a knock on NEMLIC. It is a call for the rhetoric, the changing rhetoric that we've heard in Massachusetts about how to treat drug criminalization, drug prohibition, how to treat people who do drugs. That rhetoric needs to change to action because the way that we've been doing things is not working.
Chief Fisher, please respond. I know you wanted to respond to Cade.
Well, the only thing I'd say is, so on the case that she's talking about where there was a gun located, that was because it was on the bed right within arm's reach of the person, and I remember that being documented in the after-action report. But in other cases, firearms were discovered in the apartments or homes that we conducted the search warrants on, but those documents are actually held by the police departments that conducted the searches. If it was readily available in plain sight, then it makes it into the after-action report of what our officers saw. Because once the scene is made safe, our officers leave. They back out, and the police department that applied for the search warrant comes in and does the search. And I've got to tell you, I can think of several instances right off the top of my head where there were weapons absolutely found. Actually, I can think of more than five just as I was sitting here going through my head. And, you know, a lot of times I learn those when I read the newspaper articles the next day.
Chief Fisher, let me just jump in because our time is just about to wind down, and there's a question that I really want to ask you. And this comes in the wake of Ferguson, Missouri. There was a lot of concern about the deployment of heavily armed officers. And this made the Obama administration actually ban certain types of military gear from being transferred from the feds to local police forces. And the president said, some equipment made for the battlefield is not appropriate for local police departments. Does that potentially change anything or affect anything in terms of NEMLIC?
Not that I've seen. Not the equipment that I think that they're talking about is not stuff we use. We have two Bearcats. We have a couple of vans, but they're just regular vans. I didn't see anything or hear anything that would make me think that we possess something that the president was referring to.
All right. Well, John Fisher, he's the chief of police for the town of Carlisle and president of NEMLAC's executive board. Chief Fisher, thank you very much for joining us. We're very grateful.
Thanks for having me.
And Cade Crockford is the director of the Technology for Liberty Project at the Massachusetts chapter of the ACLU. You can find a link to that document dump that we've been talking about, Cade, at radioboston.org. Cade Crockford, thank you for coming in very much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And listeners, stay with us. There's a lot more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.